At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from the Society for Human Resource Management, meeting the challenges of a changing world, online at shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937, Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Oil's high, housing's low, inflation's, well, that depends on who you ask. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy, global provider of fuels, power, and energy services. Committed to sound, efficient, sustainable energy solutions. Constellation.com. Marketplace Entrepreneurship Reporting is supported by Lenovo, official computer partner of the Olympic Games. Lenovo dedicates 1% of income to support entrepreneurship and social ventures worldwide.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you with us today. It's Tuesday, the 17th of June. And if you ask Ben Bernanke, you know what the answer is. Inflation's already too high and oil prices aren't helping any. If you'd happen to ask the Labor Department this morning, though, you'd have gotten a more nuanced answer. Overall, inflation at the wholesale level rose a substantial 1.4% last month. Less food and gas, though, not so bad. The core rate was just 0.2%. But a barrel of crude closed at $134 and a penny this afternoon, so it looks like energy-based inflation is going to be with us for a while. Saudi Arabia, the world's largest oil producer, seems to be trying to stop runaway crude prices, but some fear we all might get run over in the process. Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
This ought to be good news, an urgent move by the Saudis to hike their crude oil output ahead of a key summit of producing and consuming nations this weekend. John Kilduff is Senior Vice President for Energy at MF Global in New York.
At this point, it looks like they are in the process of laying on the market about 300,000 barrels a day of more oil in the very near future.
So why isn't this man smiling? Increased supply should put downward pressure on prices, but Kilduff points out they've just kept on climbing, even though the Saudis already added another 200,000 barrels to their production recently. Now there's a risk this latest move might just trigger more uncertainty and more volatility.
The whole idea of this is somewhat unnerving because we're literally down to our last bullets here in terms of trying to battle these high prices. And if this doesn't work, we really will not have any place else to turn in terms of there being more production.
Private energy analyst Stephen Shork agrees. He runs the research firm Energy Market Intelligence.
My fear is that the Saudis have been telling us for 10 months that the rise in crude oil has nothing to do with the availability of crude oil. So what good is a gesture of putting more barrels onto the market if you've been telling the market all along it's not a supply issue to begin with?
Indeed, the Saudis have been saying no one's really clamoring for oil. At New Edge USA, energy analyst Antoine Haff says that's because it's too expensive. So the Saudis will also need to start discounting their oil if they hope to make a difference with their increased output.
The other difficulty in bringing more oil to the market is getting consumers, buyers, to agree to buy it.
The biggest problem, though, as analyst Stephen Shork sees it, is something the Saudis can't control as much as officials in Washington.
We have to give the market and the traders who have been selling dollars and buying crude oil since last August an excuse to buy back those dollars and sell off that crude oil.
Shork says a stronger dollar is the quickest way to burst the speculation bubble. In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
We did oil and inflation. Here's today's housing report. Dismal. New home construction last month dropped to its lowest level since 1991. The AARP said today bankruptcy filings by older Americans have shot up in the past 20 years. At the same time, the number of filings has fallen for Americans under the age of 54. Jeremy Hobson has that story now from Washington.
AARP's policy director, John Rother, calls the results a worrisome sign.
People who should be saving for retirement instead being essentially wiped out at an age where they really don't have much time to recover.
Looking at these numbers, Americans aged 55 to 64, a 40% increase in bankruptcy filing. 65 to 74-year-olds, 125% increase. 75 to 84-year-olds, 433% increase. What's going on?
The most obvious explanation is healthcare costs, particularly the costs of long-term care.
He says that drives seniors deep into unmanageable debt. That's just what happened to 75-year-old Suzanne Stone of Red Hook, New York. She's retired and on the brink of filing for bankruptcy. Why?
About $10,000 for dental work, which is not covered by any kind of insurance I can get.
60-year-old William Baldwin of Overland Park, Kansas, has already filed for bankruptcy after he lost his job and dipped into his retirement savings trying to pay off debts.
Frustrating to face bankruptcy, but the alternative is worse.
Bankruptcy law professor Robert Lawless says older Americans have a harder time keeping up with growing costs.
Incomes aren't going up, and when you're 55 and over, pretty unlikely you're going to be able to increase your income.
He says that, combined with leaner pensions and health benefits, is making the golden years anything but. In Washington, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Drug makers are constantly on the lookout for their next blockbuster opportunity. And two firms on the cutting edge of Alzheimer's research are getting close. Janet Babin has more from the Marketplace Innovations Desk at North Carolina Public Radio.
Alon and Wyeth's new Alzheimer's drug has a tongue twister of a name. It's called bepanuzumab. It works by attacking the plaque deposits in the brain that are associated with Alzheimer's. It shows the most promise for people without an inherited Alzheimer's marker. That's about 60% of us. If the final trial goes well, analyst Eric Snyder with Meta Partners says bepanuzumab could become the biggest selling drug of all time.
Clearly, it's a $1 billion product or more. People are saying it could be $5 billion, it could be $13 billion.
But Snyder's still cautious about bepanuzumab's market potential. A previous trial with a drug that used a similar approach had to be stopped. Some patients came down with abnormal swelling of the brain.
So even though the drug seems very promising, I personally am concerned about the safety risks.
And then there's the competition. Myriad Genetics also has a breakthrough Alzheimer's drug on the way. More data about both drugs will be released at an Alzheimer's conference next month. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Goldman Sachs reported quarterly profits today. The granddaddy of Wall Street investment banks fell a couple of $1 billion short of last year. Still, though, not as bad as everybody had been guessing. But it was the Goldman Research Department that made actual news. They said the credit crisis isn't going to be over until sometime next year and that banks are going to need another $65 billion to tide them over. And with that, not such a great day for the major indices. We will have the details when we do the numbers. The floods that have hit the Midwest are sending already high corn prices to new records. That means meat's going to get more expensive, too. Texas, meanwhile, is dealing with brutal heat and drought. Agriculture officials there say the livestock industry stands to take an enormous hit. So if meat and corn are off the table and other grains are prohibitively expensive, what are we supposed to eat? Commentator and bioethicist Pete Singer says our diets are going to change whether we like it or not.
Why are we in the midst of a food crisis when world production of food per person has actually grown steadily since the 1960s? The answer is that we're not eating the crops we grow, sometimes not eating them at all, sometimes wasting at least 80% of them. 100 million tons of corn is turned into biofuels that go into our gas tanks. That's a lot less corn for people to eat. But most corn isn't eaten by humans, it's eaten by animals. And that's the biggest part of the problem. According to the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, 756 million tons of grain, plus most of the world's soybean crop, are fed to animals. And that amount has increased sharply in recent years, as Asian nations have become more prosperous and their populations have started eating more meat. When we use animals to convert grain and soy into food we can eat, they use most of the feed to keep warm and develop bones and other parts we can't eat. So we're wasting most of the food value of the crops we feed them. In the case of cattle, at least 9/10 of the grain they eat is squandered. Is there a simple way to solve the food crisis? Here's one suggestion. Eat less meat, dairy, and eggs. In fact, that's what our diets will look like 50 years from now, vegan or close to it. Unless, that is, someone works out how to grow environmentally friendly and commercially viable meat from cells in a lab. Last month, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, or PETA, offered $1 million for anyone who can produce commercially viable meat from a lab in 5 years. That time frame is too short. But if they were to extend the deadline to 50 years, I'd expect someone to claim the reward. And if PETA is no longer willing to pay up, the market surely will.
Peter Singer is a professor of bioethics at Princeton University. His most recent book is called The Ethics of What We Eat. You can go to our website to send us your thoughts. Our homepage is marketplace.org. Bob Moon was telling us before about Saudi Arabia and how it's working to get a handle on the price of crude. The Saudis are sort of the household name when you're talking about oil. OPEC, ExxonMobil, there are some groups and companies that are just institutions. But you might never have heard of the fastest growing oil company in the world, although you will soon. Over the past 10 years, Petrobras, Brazil's state-owned oil company, has doubled its production. It's on track to double again over the next decade, and in the process become a major factor in the U.S. oil equation. From the America's Desk at WLRN in Miami, Marketplace's Dan Gretsch reports.
When Petrobras got its start in 1953, its oil output amounted to an oil leak, less than 3,000 barrels a day. Industry insiders dismissed it as Petrosaurus. Today, it sits on one of the world's largest deepwater reserves of crude oil. It's the world's sixth largest corporation, with a market value greater than Microsoft and GE. And it's the economic engine behind an emergent Brazil. Jeremy Martin directs the energy program at the Institute of the Americas.
Brazilians like to claim that God is a Brazilian. You know, it's tough to argue these days with the run Petrobras is on.
So how did Petrobras go from industry laggard to industry leader? It started with a lucky break. Most coastal areas lack oil. The deep waters off the coast of Rio de Janeiro conceal mega deposits of crude. But it took more than divine intervention to get the oil out. For decades, Petrobras has been developing one of the most sophisticated deepwater drilling programs in the world. Energy expert Robert Bryce is author of Gusher of Lies.
It requires robotics, ultra-high-pressure production lines, sophisticated platforms that can hover in one place in ocean currents that are extremely strong. This is the modern equivalent of the space program.
And nearly as expensive. Last year, Brazil discovered the Tupi oil field, the biggest find in the Western Hemisphere in 3 decades. But developing Tupi will be Petrobras's greatest challenge yet. Its light crude lies beneath a mile of water, 2 miles of sand and bedrock, and a mile-thick dome of salt. Extracting the oil could cost $240 billion, making Tupi and nearby fields among the costliest ever developed. Robert Bryce.
Without oil at $120, $130 a barrel, some of these projects that they're involved in offshore might not go forward.
Petrobras has doubled production, while Latin America's other state-owned energy giants in Mexico and Venezuela have seen steep production declines. Brazil's emergence as an energy superpower could shift the balance of power away from leftist Venezuela. That would come as welcome news to U.S. policymakers.
In a decade or two, we could be importing more oil from Brazil than we are from Venezuela.
The key to Petrobras's success, experts say, is governance. Petrobras is state-owned, but it's ruled by market forces. Luis Cesar Stano has worked with Petrobras for 31 years.
We see ourselves as a market company, not as a governmental company.
Petrobras has opened itself to foreign competitors, even in its territorial waters. It has an independent board of directors, and it uses U.S. accounting standards. Jorge Piñon is a former Amoco executive, now with the University of Miami.
They have been able to put the politics aside and really behave like a true business. Petrobras is a business case that is going to be studied in business schools for many years to come.
Piñon says Petrobras has brought a new sense of possibility to Brazil.
That frontier, that promise, that long-term view, that vision of new riches, that is the story of Brazil. That is also the vision of Petrobras.
That vision extends to the United States. Petrobras owns a large stake in a Texas refinery and plans to drill for oil in Utah. It's investing $5 billion to explore the U.S. Gulf of Mexico. Eventually, it wants to introduce Petrobras-branded gas stations to a street corner near you. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
The last time there was labor news out of Hollywood, it was pretty easy to figure out who was who. You had the Writers Guild, the WGA, on one side, the studios on the other. Come the end of this month, though, there's going to be a whole new cast of characters to learn. They go by the acronyms SAG and AFTRA, and perhaps another strike to worry about as well. We've got Joe Adalian from TV Week on the line to help us figure out who's who and what they're doing. And Joe, first of all, SAG and AFTRA?
SAG is the Screen Actors Guild, and that represents the majority of actors that you see in TV and movie. It basically covers anything that goes on physical film. AFTRA is the American Federation of Television and Radio Actors, and it covers mostly things that are on videotape. It's a smaller union, but it has a voice in this negotiation.
And AFTRA is the one that's actually reached some kind of a deal, right?
Right. AFTRA has reached a tentative deal with the producers, and what's key is that there are 44,000 actors who are members of both SAG and AFTRA. And if AFTRA is able to get its membership to pass its deal, it takes away a lot of leverage from SAG.
And SAG is actually lobbying AFTRA members not to approve this deal, aren't they?
Exactly. They're lobbying the 44,000 members of AFTRA who are also members of SAG to reject this deal, saying it's a bad deal, that SAG can actually get more for the actors than AFTRA has negotiated already. AFTRA, of course, is outraged by this, telling SAG to butt out, and that labor chaos will ensue if the AFTRA deal is rejected.
So what are the odds, in your considered opinion, of labor chaos, an actual strike?
I still believe it's a small shot that it's going to happen. However, in recent days, the mood of the town has changed as we get closer to the June 30th expiration of the SAG and AFTRA deals, and the fact that the rhetoric coming from both sides has not gotten conciliatory at all, there's a little bit of a worry. The fact is, nobody knows anything, as often is said in Hollywood, and in this case, who knows?
Other than us missing our favorite sitcoms and maybe a couple of movies, what would this do to the business end of entertainment?
It could be devastating. You know, if it's a very short strike, just a week or so, a sort of a symbolic strike, no real impact whatsoever. However, if it goes on for more than a month or two, what you're going to see happen is you're going to see the television season delayed. The networks are hoping that the fall is going to be their chance to reintroduce themselves to viewers and really put their best foot forward. But if there's a strike and shows aren't available in September and October and all you have are reality shows, once again, you're going to see viewers fleeing to cable and Guitar Hero and not watching network TV. And if it affects the fourth quarter, the fall season, that's much more devastating to network's bottom line because they've just concluded an upfront market in which they did a lot better than they expected. And that's when the bulk of their ad money is spent, is in the fourth quarter. And if suddenly they have to go back to advertisers and say, well, we don't really have all these new fall shows we promised you, it's going to be trouble.
Do we know after the writer's strike whether or not audiences actually came back to television?
They did and they didn't. You know, they did okay with some reality shows and some sitcoms, but overall there were a lot of shows that were just down, 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 and that's continued into the summer. You know, even though summer is mostly about reality shows, the shows that have been airing in June so far have been doing really poorly.
That's because we're all sick and tired of reality shows. I mean, come on.
Well, then that's part of it. I think that's a very good point, Kai, is that, you know, there were more reality shows in the first and second quarters because of the strike, and now one of the networks doing, hey, have even more reality.
Joe Adalian's a columnist and the deputy editor at TV Week. Joe, thanks a lot.
Thank you, sir.
Coming up, Chinese entrepreneurs search for riches in the rubble. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials fell 0.8% today, 108 points to close at 12,160. The Nasdaq lopped off 0.6%, 17 points, closed at 2457. The S&P 500 lost 0.2%, 9 points, ended the day at 1350. Goldman Sachs issued that gloomy report that said credit losses won't peak until early 2009, we told you about. Then bank stocks took a beating. Washington Mutual tumbled almost 8% today. SunTrust Banks plunged almost 9%. Wachovia sank more than 5%. Shares of American Express slowed 4.33% after an analyst reaffirmed his underperform rating on the stock. He said consumer credit's going to continue to deteriorate as well as commercial. Best Buy's respectable quarterly profit report wasn't enough to convince investors the electronics retailer short-circuited 5.25% today. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 4.2%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing first-hand consumer reviews on local service like plumbers, painters, movers, and now doctors. Details at angieslist.com. Conversations from the Corner Office, Dialogues with Top CEOs, is supported by the Society for Human Resource Management, online at shrm.org. Marketplace aims to be insightful and provocative. And if you send our stories along, you can be too. Log on to our website and forward any story you hear. Every day's rundown is there, along with transcripts of the show and links to individual pieces. It's at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, President Bush is scheduled to meet with the Prime Minister of Bulgaria. The Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee discusses preparedness for this year's wildfire season. And 25 years ago, Sally Ride became the first American woman in space as a crew member on the Shuttle Challenger. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
Nothing like a story about something as wholesome as milk to get those cards and letters coming. We ran a piece about raw milk last week in which there was this piece of tape.
Would you have your child go ahead and suckle on a cow teat that had just been rolling around inside the pasture? I mean, common sense says no.
Kariamu Ose from Marina Del Rey, California, thought that was kind of alarmist.
I don't like milk of any type, not pasteurized, not raw, not made from soy or rice. But I've had the freedom to try them all, and all adults should have that option. Instead of policing my milk, I'd rather the FDA spend its time and my tax dollars helping to decentralize our food production system.
Some of you took issue with another dinner table discussion on the program, this one about food. Commentator Tyler Cowen pointed out that rising food prices overall could make higher-priced organic groceries a little easier to swallow. Alyssa Bergen from San Antonio, Texas said, nuh-uh, not in her house.
Certainly, when it's justified, I bought so-called luxury food items as well. But in a time when we're all trying to pinch pennies in order to save for the basics, I certainly can't see buying luxury goods. That didn't make a lot of sense to me.
To wash all that down, a comment or two about an interview I did with Elizabeth Reut about her new book on bottled water, Bottle Mania, it's called. Antonin Gutman and many others of you wrote to say, I forgot to ask about one of the biggest issues all those plastic bottles bring.
You should have said something about its environmental impact, because it's so obvious that there's all this manufacturing and distribution and so forth, all for almost nothing, you know, just for the fad.
I did ask. We just didn't have time to squeeze that last drop in the interview that ran. Here's what Elizabeth Reut had to say.
We recycle very few of our water bottles, mostly because we consume the water on the go when we're in cars or getting to work or school or out on trails or whatever, and there isn't always a blue bin around for recycling, so only about 14% of water bottles make it back into recycling systems, which adds up to about 30 billion water bottles a year going into landfills and incinerators.
If anything we say leaves a bad taste in your mouth, drop us a line. Go to marketplace.org and click on that link that says contact. Weeks of torrential rain in China have caused flooding across much of the southern part of that country. Not good news for the millions who are still trying to recover from last month's earthquake. Bulldozers have been able to clear some of the quake debris, but scavengers are still combing through the rest because what's left in the rubble is valuable to somebody, as Lisa Chow reports.
Ma Hongfang sits next to a big scale surrounded by piles of metal. One of her customers throws a wok, a wire chicken cage, and a stove onto the scale. Ma writes down the weight, the unit price for iron in this case, and calculates payment. Her partner, Zhou Jiaohong, says their recycling business has tripled since the earthquake.
We can recycle everything, except power lines and telephone lines, because they're considered government property.
But since no one wants to look like they're profiting from disaster, Ma plays down how much money they're making.
We have big expenses. We have to pay for transportation. The truck drivers, they make a lot more than we do.
But it's not just about profit. Ma and Zhou also lost their homes in the earthquake. These days, they sleep in tents less than 30 feet away from the trash. A mile away, Wang Youhui just finished cooking lunch. She's living in a tent between a busy road and where her house used to stand.
Bulldozers came to level it. We were lucky to get our furniture out before that. The wood beams in the house were all broken. Now they're mixed in with bricks.
So she's given others permission to collect the wood.
Maybe it's a waste, but we don't have the time or energy to deal with it. All those nails, it's dangerous.
Tang Changqing and four others load wood beams onto the back of a truck.
The family here gave us the wood for free as a gift to use as firewood for cooking.
But later, I spotted him at the recycling center. Not far away, another team, each with a large hammer in hand, takes on a much more difficult task. Finding rebar. The steel rods are embedded in concrete, and so to get them out, you've got to knock them out. Zhang Zhongque watches the others scavenge for material. He lost his house in the earthquake and has become an expert on local prices. Zhang says in the last few weeks, recycling centers are offering less and less money for wood and steel. He suspects it has something to do with the fact that there are so many people collecting material and so much material coming into the market. After all, more than 5 million buildings collapsed in last month's earthquake. Wu Fangyi has been buying up lots of old wood from individual collectors. He's in charge of the raw material supply for a factory that manufactures plywood for desks, dressers, and beds.
Before the earthquake, we didn't accept used wood. But afterwards, my boss visited the villages and was shocked by how much wood was lying around. He thought it would be good to recycle it.
Hu says the factory has invested nearly $30,000 in equipment to process used wood. And with the coming push to rebuild and refurnish houses, he hopes the investment pays off. In Pengzhou, I'm Lisa Chow for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing nearly $9 billion in municipal bond assets. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, just to make sure you heard it the first time.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments.
Before you reach for that volume knob, you should know Congress hears your pain. Not so much about radio, but about those TV ads that are so much louder than regular programs. There's a bill pending in the House that would oblige the Federal Communications Commission to set new rules for what it calls average maximum loudness. The title of the thing is the best part. It's called the Commercial Advertisement Loudness Mitigation Act, C-A-L-M, calm, get it? And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow sank 108 points, 8 tenths of 1%. The NASDAQ heaved off 17 points, 6 tenths percent. The S&P 500 lost 9 points. That's 2/3 of 1% there. Our morning show, the Marketplace Morning Report, is produced by John Buckley. Coming up next time on this program, Italy turns old crimes into new business.
Mafia businesses pay about half the minimum wage. So people began asking us for work. A wonderful slap in the face at the mafia.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.